Welcome to the second half of our session, of our morning plenary sessions. So our second speaker today is Dr. John Schottland from the Mathematics Department at the University of Michigan, whose work is generally in applied mathematics and theoretical physics, but includes inverse scattering theory and theory of random waves, of waves in random media. But if I understand correctly, your trajectory is very interesting in that you started as an MD and then later became interested in math and physics, if I'm correct. But
Actually,
we've done together. Oh, okay. At any rate, unfortunately, your machine's gone to sleep. I've forgotten the title of your talk.
Don't worry, it has already changed a couple of times.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Okay, if it's okay, I'm going to do what I learned in medical school, which is to turn the lights down so that we can actually see some of the images that will show up. So hopefully that will help. Well, first of all, I'd like to begin by thanking Adrian very much for the kind invitation to be here today. It's always a pleasure to see so many friends. Okay, so the subject of my talk is really how you image inside of a medium which is very highly scattering. For example, a glass of milk or clouds or even biological tissue. And the underlying physical problem that we would like to solve is how to find structure in that medium. So for example, to find the airplane in the clouds or the tumor in the tissue or impurities in milk, that kind of thing. And the experimental technique which people describe in this setting is known as optical tomography. And I would like to discuss relevant inverse problems. And I would like to do this at a number of different length scales, all of which are captured within the framework of what's called radiative transport theory. So let me begin by trying to give you an idea of some of the physics. And for that, unfortunately, I'll have to turn the lights off. And even then, it's not perfect. So this is an experiment. And to do it, you need a glass of water and some milk, a laser pointer, and it's helpful to have an eight-year-old. So in this experiment, we shine the light through, in this case, a beaker of water. And of course, you don't really see the laser pointer. You don't see the beam, although in the version I have, you can see its reflection off the back surface of the beaker. But if you add a little bit of milk, suddenly the beam becomes visible. There is scattering, but it's still very, very well collimated. And if you add more milk and more milk and more milk, eventually, due to multiple scattering, the beam spreads out, and you can see that down here. Okay? So the challenge is, if you have objects inside of this medium, to try to, in some way, image them from this multiply scattered light. Okay. So let me turn the lights back on. So there are a number of different regimes of interest, and the simplest, of course, is that of geometrical optics. So imagine we have now just a glass of water, and we have an object of interest inside that we would like to know something about. And we illuminate on the left with a plane wave. And what we see on the right with the detector is just that we measure a projection, right? We simply trace the rays, and wherever there is absorption of light by the object, we lose some intensity. Okay. And so this is the general principle by which, for example, X-ray CT is operating. Now, if we add a little bit of milk, then suddenly there is scattering from the particles which are inside of the medium, and the transmission of light becomes a little bit noisy, if you like. We don't really know very much about where the scatterers are, and so this is a kind of speckle pattern if the light is coherent. And if we add more milk, then the transmitted light seems to lose all information about the medium inside. Okay, so this is just a well-developed speckle pattern, let's say, in this situation. So that's, of course, the case of real interest to us. This is what happens if you shine light through tissue. And sometimes if you go into a dark room and you have a laser pointer and you transilluminate your finger, maybe you can see this, it glows red, right? Now, my grandmother used to say that if you're going to make a strudel, for example, or some other kind of pastry, that you should roll it out until it is thin enough so that you can read the New York Times behind it. Okay? That is not that regime. That is the previous regime that we saw over here. Okay, so this is the regime of strong scattering. Now, what we really want to do, of course, is to solve some kind of inverse problem, namely to find the structure inside of the medium by making measurements on the boundary. And in this case, by structure, we will think of the optical absorption as a proxy for the structure of the medium itself. Okay? So this is a classical, very, very ill-posed inverse problem, and I'll have quite a bit to say about it today. All right, but what I want to emphasize is that this problem can be understood at many, many different scales. And at virtually every scale of biological organization, there is a corresponding inverse problem, ranging from the smallest possible scales of engineered tissue. This, by the way, is the regime in which photoacoustic tomography and some of the other hybrid modalities really shine, to the mesoscopic regime. Here we are talking about specimens that are millimeters to less than centimeters thick. For example, zebrafish or other kinds of biological model systems that are of interest to embryologists, all the way to the macroscopic scale, for example, of the human breast, where the interest here is in being able to image tumors which are present inside. Okay, so how is this done in practice? Well, an experimentalist typically has a machine that looks something like this. So this is the mathematician's idea of a patient. Light is brought to the patient by means of optical fibers and then taken away by a second set of optical fibers. And then many, many source detector pairs are measured, okay? And this kind of experiment, which is at this point rather classical, hundreds to thousands of measurements are possible, okay? So that's the boundary data. And this is an example of a reconstruction that was done of a patient with breast cancer. These are different slices, coronal slices of the breast. I won't try to interpret them very much for you at this point, except to say that you can see that the images are very, very blurry, right? The resolution is quite low. That's supposed to be the tumor, and the tumor is probably less than a centimeter in size, but here it appears to take up a very, very large volume of the breast. This work was, by the way, was done at UPenn by Arjun Yode and his group. Okay, so the question, one of the questions that I'm going to talk about today is what we can do about improving this situation. And part of the answer to this is to have better instrumentation. So here is kind of a new idea for an instrument. It's in fact very, very simple. You replace all of the fibers by, first of all, on the detection side, a CCD camera. So you can think of the light coming out of this slab, for example, as being imaged onto the chip. And so if there were a million pixels in the chip, there are the equivalent of a million fibers on this face of the slab. And then the beam can be scanned on this face, and again, over thousands of positions. So it's possible to gather orders and orders of magnitude more data by this kind of approach than has ever been available in the past. Now, of course, there are two questions about this. One question is, does it make a difference? Is this a sort of profligate use of technology? And if it does make a difference, how do you compute with it? Okay. All right, so these very, very large data sets then are interesting because in principle they give you access to much, much higher spatial frequencies in the data than you would ever be able to sample with, a few hundred optical fibers. However, as I mentioned, you need fast algorithms in order to reconstruct data sets of this size, and such algorithms, unfortunately, at this point, only come in rather special geometries. So one of the geometries in which you can do quite a lot is the plane parallel one, which is actually quite convenient for mammography. And another one that you can work in rather easily is kind of the half space with a planar boundary. Okay, so I'm going to, first of all, before I tell you how those algorithms work, I want to say a few things about how light propagates in random media. And this itself is an enormous subject, and so I'll only scratch the surface. But the key point to make is that there are a number of different levels of description for this kind of physics, and they can be classified by length scale. So at the smallest scale of interest, namely the wavelength of light, one can use a description in terms of waves, the Maxwell equations. However, at the mesoscopic scale, at the order of the scattering length of light, which is something like 100 microns, there is another description, a sort of coarse-grained or homogenized version of the Maxwell equations known as the radiative transport equation. And then there is an asymptotic limit of that radiative transport equation into what is called the diffusion approximation or the diffusion equation, valid on a somewhat larger scale, typically about a millimeter in tissue. So these three different regimes, they are in some ways increasing mathematical complexity. And I will, in fact, focus on the so-called mesoscopic and macroscopic regimes in this talk. Okay? So in order to tell you what the radiative transport equation is, I first need to introduce a few important physical scales. So again, here is our sort of picture of milk. And we have scatterers. And we assume for simplicity here that the scatterers are all of the same type, that they have known absorption cross-sections and scattering cross-sections, and that the number density of those scatterers is also known. So from these three quantities, it's possible to introduce two lengths, an absorption length and a scattering length. And they are, roughly speaking, the distance that a little particle, a little photon, has to travel before it gets absorbed or scattered. And then we will work on a regime in which the scattering length is large compared to the wavelength of light. So this is, let's say, a micron, and this is 100 microns, but yet small compared to the absorption length. This is an important condition if we want to be able to actually measure anything. And again, small compared to the overall size of the system if we are in the multiple scattering regime. Okay, so with those scales in mind, we can now write down the radiative transport equation. So here is the beast. So this, I should say, first of all, is normally written as a kinetic equation, so I have written the time-independent form of it, but it simply guarantees the conservation of a quantity known as the specific intensity. So this is the intensity of light at a point in the medium traveling in a particular direction, which we call S, and now there are several terms in this equation. So the first term on the left-hand side here is simply the term that tells you to transport the specific intensity in the direction S. So if nothing else were going on, this would be geometrical optics. You simply have a ray, and you move in the direction of the ray. The second term here allows for losses due to absorption, where this absorption coefficient mu a is simply the reciprocal of the absorption length. And the term on the right accounts for gains and losses due to scattering. So for example, if you have a little scatterer, and you send a wave in the direction S, and another wave comes out in the direction S prime, then you introduce a quantity which is called the phase function, P, which is simply the normalized differential scattering cross-section. It integrates up to 1 over all angles. You can think of this as the conditional probability for this event to have occurred. And here we simply have the gains and losses due to scattering in and out of the direction S, weighted by the overall efficiency of scattering, which we call mu S, the scattering coefficient. Okay? So this is the radiative transport equation. And it's important to point out that although it is a very, very nice way to think about the transport of light in the random medium, not all of the relevant physics is present. So in particular, you'll notice that we add intensities in this equation. And so what that means is that we don't account for the effects of interference in certain situations. So for example, Anderson localization is not something which would be predicted by an equation of this kind. It's also not something of direct interest to us physically. Okay, so let me start off by discussing the very, very simplest bit of physics which is contained inside of the radiative transport equation, and that is the situation in which there is no scattering whatsoever. So the entire right-hand side of that equation disappears, the phase function is no longer there, and we simply say that we are transported in the direction S and then attenuated with a special rate mu A. So the specific intensity in this situation is simply the incident intensity attenuated by the integral of the absorption along the line of propagation, okay? And so this is precisely the situation that obtains in standard tomography of X-rays, for example, and it leads to the radon transform and all of the technology that one is interested in that case. Okay, so now what I want to do is to discuss how the radiative transport equation applies at mesoscopic scales. So these are scales in which the system size is roughly of order the scattering length. So this is the sort of millimeter to submillimeter regime. Okay. So let's consider an experiment in which we have an optically thin medium, by which I mean that if we have a narrow incident collimated beam, that this beam will scatter roughly one time inside of the medium. Okay. So a beam will enter on the left, it will encounter a scattering center, change direction, and exit. Okay? And we call such beams broken rays. Now, if we have a detector over here, for example, which is angularly selective, and the medium has and the light has undergone one scattering event, then of course we will only measure the ballistic ray, right? Now, if we take this detector off axis a little bit, move it up, and incline it at a certain angle, then we will measure the broken ray. Okay? So by a careful angular selection, it is possible to measure the predominantly single scattered photons. Okay. Okay, so let's try to be a little bit more precise about this mathematically. So now I want to write down the full radiative transport equation with both absorption and scattering terms present, and the phase function, of course, on the right-hand side, which accounts for scattering. Okay. So how do I solve this equation? Well, I can try to introduce the proper Green's function. And so the specific intensity is then the incident intensity plus a term which accounts for scattering. Okay. And so this is the so-called ballistic Green's function. It is the Green's function which describes what happens in the absence of any scattering, okay, with mu s equal to 0. And if you like, you can think of these as kind of secondary sources of light. And you'll notice that just as in the usual case of the Lippmann-Schwinger equation for waves, the specific intensity appears on both the left-hand side of the equation and the right-hand side, and so we can iterate it. And if we do so, then we can obtain what is sometimes called the collision expansion. And so the first term in this expansion represents the specific intensity without scattering. The second term represents the single scattering events and double scattering, and so on. Okay. So this is formally analogous to what happens with wave equations, but now in the context of the radiative transport equation. Okay, so let's focus our attention now on single scattering events, which means that we stop that collision expansion after two terms. And suppose we can now write a formula for the change in intensity that will be measured at a detector in a fixed direction if the light is coming in at a source in another direction. Okay, so we need to know the Green's functions, which propagate from source to detector and so forth, the phase function, and the scattering coefficient inside of the medium. Now, what is the Green's function here? So this is the Green's function which describes ballistic propagation, that is to say, propagation without scattering. And you'll see that it has sort of three components. So the first term here simply gives you exponential decay from the total of attenuation inside of the medium divided by r squared. So this is the usual 1 over r squared law for transport of intensity. But then there are two very, very important delta functions. In fact, the first delta function says you should look along the direction of sight. So this is the ballistic direction. And the second delta function says do it twice. Right? So there are really important singularities here. And those singularities, in fact, are the reason why it is possible to invert, for example, the radon transform in a very, very nice way. And it will also turn out that they allow you to invert the next order of scattering, which I'm going to talk about now. But after two orders of scattering, it turns out that you integrate out both of these delta functions, and the specific intensity becomes smooth. Okay, and for this reason, it's very, very hard to do optical tomography. Okay, so you shake a little bit, as Guillaume says, and what do you find? You find the specific intensity, the change in specific intensity before and after. You make the measurement with the scatterer present, is simply related to some geometrical factors, which I won't discuss. And now here we see the important idea, which is that you should integrate the total attenuation along the broken ray, which starts at the source, turns at the turning point R, which has length L1, and then continues from the turning point until it exits the medium. Okay, so this is essentially a line integral along the broken array. And so the idea here is that you can directly measure these line integrals. Okay, so this leads us to introduce what we call the broken array Radon transform, which is simply the integral of a function along a broken array. And the broken arrays are parameterized, let's say, in a plane by the point of incidence and a direction and the point at which they exit and a direction. Okay? So the inverse problem of recovering this function f from the broken array Radon transform is to measure the left-hand side and to recover f itself. Now, the first thing you notice in the plane is that the problem is overdetermined, right? There are 4 degrees of freedom on the left-hand side here and 2 degrees of freedom on the right. So what we'll do is fix the direction of incidence, as I described in the earlier experiment, and fix the direction at which the light goes out. Okay? And so now if we imagine that we make measurements for many, many different pairs of broken arrays, many points and detectors, then in principle it might be possible to recover f for measurements. The problem then at least is formally determined. Okay, so the good news is, in fact, that there are inversion formulas for this broken array transform. And I've just written it out a little bit more explicitly in this geometry here. So this is the first term, and this is the second term after the array turns. And I won't say very much about how these inversion formulas are derived, but I will, in fact, write one down for you. And this is what it looks like. So this is the function f that you want to know, and this is the data. Okay, and you'll notice that you, just like in the sort of standard Radon transform, you have to take derivatives, but in this case, you have to take two. Okay. So the stability of inverting this broken array transform is not quite as nice as the stability of inverting a standard Radon transform, but in fact, it's not so bad. And I'll just make a few observations that unlike standard chromography, you don't have to collect projections along rays which are rotated about the sample. You simply fix the direction of the sample, fix the directions of incident and outgoing light, and there is enough information because of the scattering to invert the transform. Okay, so this formula can be inverted. I'll now show you some numerical results. So this is a slab. This is in this direction is a slab we call Z. This we call Y. So this is a relatively small inhomogeneity in the slab. These are larger and larger inhomogeneities. And these are cross sections in the Y and Z direction. Okay. So this is absolutely inverse crime. This just tells you the best you can expect in a situation like this. Okay, so there's a lot of theory of these inversion formulas, which we won't have time to discuss, but I could discuss them later. Okay, so now I want to move on from the mesoscopic regime to the macroscopic regime. So here you should have in mind imaging of breast tumors, for example, in patients with breast cancer. Okay, so now I want to go back and I want to rewrite the radio transport equation for you. But the setting here is a little bit different. So instead of only accounting for ballistic scattering perturbatively, here I want to account for all orders of scattering, but assume that the medium has an absorption which is inhomogeneous and varies from point to point. So I'll take the absorption and I will decompose it into a constant background piece plus a spatially fluctuating piece, which we call delta mu a. And again, we can write down the corresponding integral equation, which says that the specific intensity is the incident intensity, in this case decreased due to absorption inside of the medium. And now we need to know the Green's function for the radiative transport equation, but this is not the ballistic Green's function, okay? It's red, it's not blue. That Green's function is the Green's function for the full radiative transport equation with homogeneous scattering and absorption, and so forth. Okay, so again, this is a sort of multiple scattering, sort of Lippmann-Schwinger type picture, and so we can make a Born approximation, and that's all I will talk about today. So I'll replace on the right-hand side of this equation the specific intensity by the incident intensity, and then I will refer to phi as the data, scattering data, and the problem, which is really just the difference between the incident intensity and the intensity which is measured in the medium. And so now the scattering data depends upon, of course, a source and a detector and their respective directions, and is related to the absorption inside of the medium by this integral equation, if you know the Green's functions. Okay, so the great difficulty here is that in general, we don't know the Green's functions for the radiative transport equation. So let me just say a few things about that. So the radiative transport equation has a long history. It was first, I think, discussed in the astrophysics community almost over 100 years ago, and the idea was to try to study the propagation of light in stellar atmospheres. And this forced several physical conditions. Namely, that typically one thinks about plane parallel atmospheres, so essentially one-dimensional problems, and also isotropic scattering, meaning that that phase function that we discussed before is independent of angle, so it's just constant. Okay? So in that situation of one-dimensional isotropic scattering with planar boundaries, there are exact solutions to the transport equation, and they're either classical, they were worked out by Chandrasekhar in the 1940s, in three spatial dimensions, with isotropic scattering and without boundaries, there are also solutions to the equation, but that is about it. The catalog of solutions is maybe five or six total. So people resort to approximate methods. They replace those Green's functions by various things known as PL approximations or diffusion approximations and so forth. So let me first tell you about that. And then I will tell you about some work that we have done in which we have managed to be able to create exact solutions to the RTE with arbitrary phase functions in three dimensions with anisotropic scattering, but still, of course, homogeneous constant backgrounds. Okay, so let me first of all remind you about the diffusion approximation. And so the idea here is that we account for the lowest order of spatial anisotropy, of angular anisotropy, in the Green's function. And so we write a decomposition into spherical harmonics, that's essentially what this is, of the Green's function for the RTE, in terms of this Green's function G for a diffusion equation, which involves the scattering in the medium through the diffusion coefficient D0 and the absorption in the medium over here. Okay? So it's known that the diffusion approximation is accurate. It's a good approximation as long as the intensity varies slowly on the scale of L star, which is the essentially isotropic scattering length inside of the medium. It's about a millimeter in tissue. Now, it's a good approximation, but it breaks down in a number of situations. For example, in very, very thin layers, with weak scattering, near boundaries, strong absorption, and so on. But yet, it is the workhorse of this field. So let's see what happens if we want to work with it. So if I write the integral equation that we had before for the scattering data in terms of the absorption of the medium, replace the Green's functions by their corresponding Green's functions within the diffusion approximation, then I have a much, much simpler Green's function. Okay? So this is the Green's function for a diffusion equation, let us say within a slab geometry. So what does that Green's function look like? So I'm going to belabor this point because it will come up again when I discuss the Green's function for the full RTE. So the key point here is that in the slab, it's possible to decompose the Green's function into two-dimensional plane waves. So they sort of propagate along this direction, but they decay exponentially at high frequencies into the medium. Okay? And you can see right away from looking at these formulas why it is that optical tomography is so ill-posed, because you see we lose high frequencies exponentially fast. And so in some sense, if you want to grow them back again, it's trouble. Okay. Now, so how do people solve the inverse problem? Well, there are lots of ways, but the simplest, most straightforward way is to take this integral equation and simply discretize the medium, sample the data that you want on the boundary, assume that you want to sample absorption inside of the medium in some useful way, and now discretize the whole thing. It becomes a set of algebraic equations, and you solve those equations. And that is indeed the way that much optical tomography is done. However, it's computationally expensive to solve large systems of linear equations when you have maybe 10 to the 8 by 10 to the 6 is the size of the matrix. So instead, what we look for is a direct method, a sort of inversion formula for this type of equation. And those inversion formulas can be seen to exist in certain special geometries. So I won't say a lot about this, but let me just give you the flavor of it. So if we look back at the integral equation, and imagine now that we take data on the slab, right? So this is one face of the slab where the sources are. This is the second face where the detectors are present. Let us suppose that we take this data and Fourier transform it. So do two-dimensional Fourier transforms of the data and make use of that plane wave decomposition and calculate a little bit. And what you find out is that the Fourier transform data, the sort of four-dimensional Fourier transform data, can be related to the absorption inside of the medium by a kind of Fourier Laplace transform. So it is Fourier-like in the direction of the plates, and it is Laplace-like in the depth direction. You see, this is where the spatially where the spatial frequencies are lost. You see, here's the exponential decay. Now, what do you do with such a thing? Well, you can look at it, and you can see right away, well, suppose I want to find delta alpha. What should I do? Well, I can try to make some sort of change of variables and invert the Fourier part and the Laplace part separately. And in fact, that's exactly what you do. So it's simple to invert the Fourier transform. Inverting the Laplace transform with real data, without analytic continuation, is a long story, but there are ways to do this as well. The singular functions and singular values of the Laplace transform operator are known. And what you see is that the inverse problem is quite well behaved in the transverse direction, where you simply have to take apart the Fourier modes. But in the depth direction, of course, things break down, and you lose high frequencies when you have to grow them back. Okay? So what this tells you is that somehow in the transverse direction, if you have a lot of data, then you should be able to do a reasonably good job at that inversion. And so that tells you, well, you need large data sets, and you should expect that the highest spatial frequencies in the reconstructions are related to the highest spatial frequencies in the measurements. And all of this is true to some extent. In practice, noise and other things become important. Okay, so let me show you how this kind of stuff actually works in practice. So this is experimental data from real experiments that were done in the laboratory of Arjun Yod at Penn. So this is what a real experiment sort of schematically looks like. Here's the phantom. In our case, this is either 5 or 6 centimeter thick specimen with optical properties that are at least to light indistinguishable from breast tissue. And here are the sources, which are steered by a pair of mirrors. And here's the camera. Okay, so this is a completely homogeneous tank now with a normally oriented source and just a single photograph of the light which comes out. And you can see it has a nice circular symmetry, as you might expect, about the center of the beam. And if you would simply plot the intensity along a straight line, then it falls off away from the source. As you'll notice, it falls off very, very smoothly. There are not a lot of high frequencies here, and this, of course, is the problem. Okay, so if you take many such exposures from, let's say, thousands of sources, then you can make reconstructions that look like this. So these are two small metal balls that are placed in the mid-plane of that 5 centimeter tank, and these are reconstructions into slices sort of 2.5 millimeters apart. Okay? So these balls, I think, are 8 millimeters in size, and they're very, very high contrast. But these were the first set of experiments that were done. With about 10 to the 8 measurements, we can do a complete reconstruction in just under 10 minutes of CPU time. So this data is actually, at this point, about 5 years old. So in a sort of second generation experiment, we tried to be a little bit more precise about what the resolution and capabilities of this instrument are. So here we make some bar targets. Unfortunately, it's very hard to see with this projector what's going on. But these are bar targets that are placed in the center of that tank. So that's the deepest place they can be, in some sense. And the bars are separated. So here this is 10 millimeters, so the bars here are separated by 5 millimeters. So here they're separated by about 4, and well, you can't really see it here, but this image is actually quite good. So these are cross sections. There are about 10 to the 7 measurements here, and the amount of reconstruction time on a simple PC is just about a minute or so. And this shows what happens if you remove some of the spatial measurements from the detector. And again, it's about optimal at about 10 to the 7 measurements, just a bit under. And then you can see that you lose information. The pictures are really much better over here. If you'd like to see them, I'd be happy to show you later. So this is an attempt to show that you can actually see anatomy, or a proxy for anatomy. So these are letters that are 3 millimeters in size. Now the tank is 6 centimeters across. The contrast here is about physiologic, and these are present simultaneously in the tank, and you can read them fairly well. At least I can read them. And it's about 10 to the 7 measurements again. So you can see sort of millimeter scale features in these letters. Okay. So the next step then is to try to look at what happens when the diffusion approximation breaks. Okay. So when does this occur? So as I mentioned earlier, in optically thin samples, so samples that are, say, a centimeter or less in thickness, relatively weakly scattering media, very, very strongly absorbing, and so forth. Okay, so to deal with such things, we need to go back to the full radiative of transport equation. And that means that we need to get our hands somehow on the Green's function. So to make a long story short, we need to find some way to construct Green's functions. And these Green's functions should be useful in the situation where there is anisotropic scattering. The phase function is known, let us suppose, but is not constant. And when there are boundaries, let's say planar boundaries. So the construction of this Green's function is something that I don't have a lot of time to talk about. But let me just say that in some sense you can think of it as analogous to the construction of the Green's functions for the diffusion equation itself, which is to say we want to look for modes of the radiative transport equation, and we will assume that they are evanescent, just like the modes of the diffusion equation. So the spatial part should look like a diffuse wave, which is propagating in one direction and decaying in the other, and then there is overall some kind of angular dependence, an amplitude which is angularly dependent. Okay, so if you like, you can think of these as kind of the analogs of the CGOs for the RTE. Okay. So to make a long story short, one can in fact, in the special geometry that I mentioned with planar boundaries, compute analytically these amplitudes by working with a special type of spherical functions. And at the end of the day, you can write the Green's function for the RTE as a decomposition into two-dimensional plane waves in the spatial part. And in the angular part, these are special spherical harmonics. They are spherical harmonics in a special rotated reference frame. I won't say too much about them. And these little g's over here, well, they involve Wigner functions for SO3. And there's an eigenproblem which has to be solved once for every phase function that you choose. These exponentially decaying weights here are analogous to the weights that we saw at high frequencies in the diffusion approximation. And the key point here is that this decomposition for the Green's function has a completely analytical dependence, an explicit dependence on positions and directions. And although there is a small numerical part where you have to diagonalize a tridiagonal matrix to compute some of these numbers, once that is done, and it only has to be done once for each phase function, you have the Green's function. Okay? And it has a very nice and useful form because of this decomposition into plane waves and spherical functions. Okay. So, life becomes a little bit more complicated in the radiative transport picture because we now have to explicitly somehow account for the angular dependence of the data, right? And in a real measurement, of course, the camera that you're interested in has some sort of aperture, and in fact, you must know that in some way, and you integrate the measurements over, the specific intensity, rather, over this aperture in order to get the measured intensity. Okay. So in some situations, this aperture function is known and very easy to account for, and essentially, it corresponds to being able to pick a fixed direction in which the light goes out, say, normal to the surface. Okay, so what happens to the inverse problem? Well, if you have complete data, that is to say, you have all directions of incidence and all directions in which the light goes out on the boundary, then it turns out, from work of Plum and Stefanov and Trulli and Gunther Ullmann, that the problem of recovering the pair of coefficients, mu A and mu S, the absorption and scattering coefficients, is quite nice. It's well posed, there's Holder stability, and so forth. On the other hand, if you have incomplete angular data, for example, you have directions, only one incoming direction and one outgoing direction, then the problem becomes, again, exponentially ill-posed. Okay? And the best you can hope for is to recover the low-frequency information about the coefficients just the way you have to in the diffusion approximation itself. Okay? Unfortunately, it's very, very difficult experimentally to get your hands on all of the required angular data. And so we are really forced into this situation of looking only at the angularly averaged case. Okay, so let us consider that case and go through the same kind of procedure that we did for the diffusion approximation, namely to write down the Green's functions, decompose them into plane waves, do the proper Fourier transform of the measurements with respect to source and detector positions, and what you find is that the Fourier transformed scattering data is simply the Fourier Laplace transform of the quantity delta mu A that you want to know, but now summed over all of the various modes which come up into the RTE. Okay? But nevertheless, the same kind of game can be played. You can make appropriate changes of variables, invert the Fourier part, then invert the Laplace part, I'll now show you what happens. So these are simulations, first of all. So here we have an optically thin medium. It is 5 L star thick, so that's 5 millimeters in physical units. We put a single point absorber in the center, and we reconstruct it both using the radiative transport equation and the diffusion approximation, which essentially consists of keeping only one mode in that decomposition. And you can see here that the results are far better, of course, of the transport equation. The resolution is quite good in the depth direction and much better even in the transverse direction. There are more frequencies that one can get your hands on. This is again inverse crime, and we do this purely to make the point that this is the best you could hope for. Okay. By inverse crime here, I mean that we don't add any noise. That's all. Okay, so this is now again experimental data from the Yode laboratory in Philadelphia. So this is now a 1 centimeter thick tank containing intralipid. It's all physiologic. And we put 2 absorbing bars in the center. And this is the reconstruction done essentially within the diffusion approximation. And this is the reconstruction done within the RTE. So green here is diffusion, and this is RTE. Okay? So it's obviously much better. So these bars here are about a millimeter or millimeter and a half in size, and separated by the same distance. Okay, so there is a substantial improvement in resolution. So this is a somewhat different demonstration of the same concept, but now done in the reflectance or backscattering geometry. So here is the sample of interest. The light comes in from the top and comes back. Okay. And now there's another small point here, which I won't dwell on, which is that we don't use point sources for the illumination. We use some kind of structured illumination, so we illuminate directly with eigenfunctions, and that makes it easier to take the data. Okay, so here are reconstructions of 4 little tubes at different levels of contrast, buried 3 millimeters below the surface. So this is a situation in which the diffusion approximation really breaks badly. as you're within this boundary layer, which is about a centimeter or so thick. You can see the reconstructions are quite reasonable. And then finally, I want to show you a reconstruction of something which has, let us say, more biological relevance. And so at the same time, we didn't want to have to deal with the IRB. So you go to the grocery store and you buy a lemon and a lotus root, which is a quite delicious vegetable that is very commonly used in Chinese and Japanese cuisine. So this is it's a pity you can't see the images better, but this is these are slices through the lemon, a millimeter apart. So this is a lemon which has been cut, its ends truncated and stuck into the middle of that 5-centimeter tank. And you can see the septations. And I think in this picture at least, you can see some of the seeds and so on. So this is really quite good for diffuse light. And this is a lotus root. And again, here you can see some of the holes. They are better visualized over here. And I believe that this is a good time to stop. Thank you very much.